Hello, my name's Jane McNaughton. I come from the University of Durham, where I'm involved in the field of medical humanities. And I've come today to talk about the links between medical humanities and this idea of the fifth wave in public health. Well, thank you very much, Phil. It really is a massive pleasure to be invited back to my hometown of Glasgow to talk to you this evening. I would describe medical humanities certainly as a field. It was interesting, I was in a discussion on the way over here. It's interesting when you've been in a field for a long time how your ideas about it begin to change. At first I thought medical humanities is a new discipline and it's going to change the world. But actually I would describe it as a kind of interdiscipline. And I'll say a little bit more clearly about that as we go through. But this is a particular pleasure for me because this event is the result of interactions that are all too rare in academic life, but I think are often the way that thinking progresses. I'm not a public health physician, but I'm a kind of rather odd GP, as Phil suggested. I started out reading history and English at Glasgow University, progressed through to medicine, and then studied philosophy with Robin Downey, who was one of the great originators of our field, medical humanities. But looking back, I feel public health has always been in my consciousness. Before I moved from Glasgow to Durham, recruited by Ken Carman, who's well known to you here in Glasgow, I spent 6 months on a welcome fellowship investigating the work of the great general practitioner Sir James Mackenzie, who established the Institute for Clinical Research at St Andrews in 1919. And as a result of that fellowship, I argued that this institute was the first attempt to establish general practice as a research field. That research was firmly established on public health lines, with its aim of collecting population data on illnesses, along with information on living conditions, with the intention of observing the early signs of illness. But I think the wider concerns of public health were most in evidence when my colleagues and I established the Centre for Medical Humanities at Durham as a result of a welcome grant in 2008. The aim of that work was to pursue ideas under the theme medicine and human flourishing. As part of that project, I started to do some work on smoking, which I'll say a bit more later. And in the course of that, another colleague alerted me to Phil Hanlon, Andrew Lyon, David Riley and others' 2011 article making the case for a fifth wave in public health. Reading that article was really a seminal moment for me as I traced many connections with our thinking in medical humanities. But what really excited me was here was a group of people who were not only articulating a fundamental critique of current ways of doing things in public health, they're proposing a way forward and seem genuinely determined to make progress. So having known Phil, as he said, when I was here as a lecturer in general practice in Glasgow, I boldly decided to get in touch. And he and Andrew and I met here last November to discuss how medical humanities and these ideas might interact. So this lecture is their invitation for me to put my money where my mouth is. So I hope I'll be able to do that. It's important for me to emphasise a few things at the outset. First, I do come from outside public health, and I need corrections to any naive assumptions I might make. But I stand by my intrusion here because it seems to me important that new ideas are watered, strengthened and extended by insights from outside their home discipline. And second, my approach, like my colleagues here, is to try to make a difference, not just to be negatively critical. And third, I come at this problem not just as a medical humanities specialist, but as a still practicing clinician whose bread and butter is individual interactions with patients rather than the broader concerns of population medicine, although I do, in fact, practice in cervical screening at the moment. So my focus has always been on the individual rather than on the collective, but it seems there are important translational insights in line with fifth wave ideas. So I've got quite a lot of tasks in this lecture. I need to give you a sense of the current status and trajectory of medical humanities. But I also need to say something about the fifth wave. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to start off with some common origins for these two areas of thinking, to move on to some parallel tracks in medical humanities and in public health, new ideas, and then to attempt to identify any advantages and challenges of walking along together. And I've pursued these tracks with a genuine sense of inquiry, following some illuminating routes. I hope you find it takes you somewhere rather than snarling us up in some kind of spaghetti junction. So I'm going to start by characterising my field, and I think many of you may not be that familiar with medical humanities. So here's a fairly characteristic starting point. If we consider these two very different accounts of the side effects for treatment for breast cancer. First of all, from the New England Journal of Medicine, an article on side effects of adjuvant treatment for breast cancer. I'm quoting, "Many women with breast cancer who are receiving adjuvant chemotherapy have fatigue, and about two-thirds of them rate the level of fatigue as moderate or severe. The fatigue appears to resolve after treatment. In a survey of nearly 2,000 women with breast cancer who were evaluated 3 years after adjuvant treatment, the level of fatigue was similar to that of age-matched women." And here is an old friend of mine, the poet Julie Darling, in a poem called Chemotherapy from her book Sudden Collapses in Public Places. This is her poem. "I did not imagine being bald at 44. I didn't have a plan, perhaps a scar or two from growing old. Hot flushes, I'd sit fluttering a fan. But I am bald and hardly ever walk by day. I'm the invalid of these rooms, stirring soups, awake in the half dark, not answering the phone when it rings. I never thought that life could get this small, that I could care so much about a cup, the taste of tea, the texture of a shawl, and whether or not I should get up. I'm not unhappy. I've learned to drift and sip. The smallest things are gifts." These two pieces of writing illustrate starkly the different perspectives of medical research and the patient in relation to illness. From the medical perspective, it's important to know the side effects of powerful treatments so that an evaluation can be made about risks in relation to longer-term benefits for the patient. What medicine does, of course, is to look to clinical science, to the RCT or cohort study at population or large group level to come up with the answers. And this is quite right and acknowledged as a good in the light of the fifth wave public health approach. Of course, patients are keenly interested in these issues too. They want to know about side effects, how long they will last, how serious they will be. But this information does not represent illness for the patient in the way it does for doctors. For patients, illness is defined by what they experience, the effects it has on their ability to do things, to relate to others, to live as they have before in the world. What medical humanities has largely been known for, then, has been to reintroduce this human-scale record back into the education of medical students and to doctors through making use of the rich resources largely of literature, art and philosophy. I say back in advisedly because post-enlightenment, with the advent of scientific medicine and actually being able to do something for patients, something has been lost. Here's a description by Dr. Charles Badham in his 1814 essay on bronchitis, describing a patient suffering from bronchitis acuta. And Badham writes, "Wheezing is not in this stage a constant, perhaps not a common symptom. If the disease remained for a few days unsubdued by proper treatment or have been hitherto neglected, the symptoms of excessive action suddenly disappear and the pulse becomes quite feeble and of almost countless frequency. Partial sweats break out at intervals, and the patient, after spitting up an immense quantity of sputa, various in appearance, till from feebleness he can expectorate no longer, dies from the accumulation, the last hours in such cases exhibiting very dreadful struggles with the disease, and the patient often becoming delirious before he sinks under it." What's notable here is that this is a record of a doctor who sits in watch over his patient, recording the symptoms, but also accompanying him in his struggles, with considerable expression of compassion until the patient succumbs. What we try to do in medical humanities is to impress upon students and doctors how it is that illness is lived and experienced, so they can bear this in mind as they interact with patients. But this kind of approach leaves medicine basically untouched. It is an embellishment rather than an attempt critically to engage with how medicine goes about its practice, thinks about its evidence base, examines its place within the wider ways of thinking about how lives go well or badly. The idea of medical humanities as addressing deficiencies in the education of doctors underlines Howard Brody's that was the Badham slide, which you just saw there. So Howard Brody, who's been one of the major proponents of the field of medical humanities in the States, has a way of distinguishing what medical humanities is about, and the educational context underlies his three notions. He describes medical humanities as having these three different characterizations. First of all, a list of disciplines. That's the idea that medical humanities offers medical students specifically educational opportunities at university level in various humanities disciplines so they can obtain a broader liberal education. And secondly, a program of moral development, the idea derived from the 14th century poet Plutarch that an education too heavily based on technical knowledge and skills does not educate the judgment. And thirdly, a supportive friend proposed by the Canadian father of modern medicine, Sir William Osler, who recommended classical literature as bedtime reading. Reading music, art, etc., might be seen in this view as a solace after a hard day at the clinical coalface. Not necessarily a kind of mushy, distracting solace, but one that helps to make sense of the suffering and pain the doctor must necessarily deal with. Now, these three characterizations, you can see, focus entirely on the supporting the doctor's education. And not for a moment really do they critique or undermine the basis of that education, which is biomedical science. I think our field does inhabit all these personalities, depending on where you find the purpose it's being put to. But what we're trying to articulate in the field, and particularly at Durham, is at one end of the spectrum, the idea of a critical friend, and at the other, disruptive teenager. The emergence of this personality heralds a new phase for the medical humanities, of deeper engagement between medicine and the disciplinary perspectives of the humanities, social science and science, but it's also a return to the roots of the field, the initial stimulus for its origins back in the 1970s, that the disciplines of bioscience and even bioethics were insufficient to explain the concerns of medicine contextualised within the lived experience of humanity. It's very important to emphasise, as Raymond Tallis does in his book Hippocratic Oaths, how successful scientific medicine has been at achieving increased life expectancy and quality and delivering us from the horrors of what Tallis calls the inhumanity of the body. But it's also important to realise what assumptions about the body are being made in scientific medicine. From the early Enlightenment period, Tallis notes, the idea of the body as a carnal machine emerged as an intellectual framework for a systematic investigation of its component mechanisms. The philosopher Mary Midgley, in her book Science and Poetry, critiques the persistence of this metaphor. She describes the origins of what might be considered as the first wave of modern science, and attributing it to the power of a metaphor to direct thinking creatively in a new way. Midgley writes, the invention in the Renaissance of real complex machines such as clocks gave the human imagination an immensely powerful piece of new material. Machine imagery changes the worldview profoundly because machines are by definition under human control. They can, in a sense, be fully understood because they've been taken to pieces. And if the world is essentially a machine, then it can be taken to pieces too and reassembled more satisfactorily. It was the fusion of these two imaginative visions, says Midgley, that made modern science look possible, and it had to look possible before anyone could actually start doing it. So progress in bioscience has relied upon this atomistic breaking down, top-down, highly systematised and generalised approach to understanding. Molecular and indeed submolecular and genetic investigations have led to new treatments. The testing of these treatments depends on RCTs in which the bumps and inconsistencies of individual difference are flattened in group identity and sameness. Treatment delivery is by clinicians whose training, even in communication, requires learning a framework within which doctor and patient are assumed to pose particular kinds of questions and respond in anticipated ways. Public health is not immune. The idea of nudging to bring about behaviour change, for example, assumes a vision of the human that is Pavlovian, unable to be self-actualising. People are entities that need to be worked upon, not individuals with their own ideas, distinctive values, and power to develop in unexpected ways. Now, this approach has been successful in delivering a certain kind of technical medical care, but it may be that in holding to the conception of the human in which this progress has been so far based might hamper new directions and further understanding in medicine. 100 years after his death, the American philosopher and psychologist William James is beginning to influence work in this field, particularly in neuropsychology and the work of Antonio Damasio, and a growing number of philosophers and literary scholars. James is critical of traditional empirical work, which has an atomistic tendency to divide up the body and the psyche into simple subunits and to deal with each individually. My colleague, the literary scholar Pat Waugh, writes, "James, the only American philosopher in his time trained in medicine, cautioned his own age against misplaced infatuation with a medical materialism that operates a positivist insistence on the absolute separation of facts and values. As James himself writes, there's no purely objective standard of sound health. We should abandon our notion of health instead of we should broaden our notion of health instead of narrowing it. In short, we should not be afraid of life." So I think in some of these ideas that are kind of the origins of medical humanities, there's a lot of foundational common ground with the thinking my colleagues have been undertaking in the critique that lies at the base of the fifth wave idea, which I'm using Andrew's diagram here. So we've got the power of scientific rationalism still holding sway as a major force directing thinking and practice in medicine, where we've got the second wave. The success of this in reducing mortality and morbidity, but a suggestion that this conception is beginning to hold things back, that its narrow focus in directing thinking about modern epidemics of obesity, respiratory disease, mental health problems, that's in the fourth wave, is preventing more creative thinking. This narrowness consists in a reductionist approach that's dependent on the vision of the human and our world as machines that can be fixed and that has a strong hold on our thinking. The important thing to remember is that metaphors may outlive their usefulness. It appears that it's time for some new ones, as we're failing to make significant progress on the big health problems of our Western society. The justification for proposing a new fifth wave in public health is based on the redundancy of this vision and its let's fix it approach in taking the major public health problems of the West, obesity, social inequalities in health, and loss of well-being despite relative economic wealth in the context of growing economies. The current approach is costly in terms of the finite resources of both money and the global reserves of our ever-expanding population. And the sense is that we're kind of racing headlong into a crisis may actually be causing the kind of existential malaise that is the root cause of some of these epidemics. So, having paused to suggest some of the emerging common ground, let's me just remind you of the kind of six emergent qualities of the fifth wave that Phil and Andrew and colleagues have described in one of their papers, because I want to now turn to some of the specifics of work in medical humanities, which will illustrate what role the arts and humanities have in providing some of these new ways of thinking and perhaps directing our steps. Okay, first one is the public health community is not dealing with simple predictive systems that are amenable to fixing, but with complex adaptive systems with multiple points of equilibrium that are sensitive to small changes in the system. The second is that we have a need to rebalance our mindset from anti to pro, from dominion and independence from top down to interdependence and cooperation, from institutional and expert-led to work derived from interdependence and cooperation, emphasising the capacity to learn with and from others. Thirdly, our models and metaphors, I was talking about metaphors, need to change. Mechanistic understanding of ourselves as mechanics and fixers to the more organic metaphors, which promote understanding of health professionals as, for example, gardeners, they suggest, enabling growth and flourishing and nourishing the individual or community's own capacity for health. And fourthly, there's a need to integrate objective scientific analysis and understanding with the subjective understanding of experience and inner lives. Fifthly, we need to develop a future consciousness to inform the present, recognising the unsustainability of our current lifestyles dependent on ever-increasing growth, and develop different forms of growth than the economic to promote human welfare. And finally, we need to iterate and scale up through learning, trying things out and sharing ideas. So I'd like now, in the second part of this lecture, to illustrate how we in medical humanities are working with some of these principles in exactly the way envisaged here, not by rejecting the achievements of the past, but building upon them and refining them. Okay. We're interested in words in the humanities, and clearly words are central to medical interactions. It's a truism to say that patients bring words of description to the medical interaction and emerge with other words of explanation. We are interested in the implication of words and their power in the medical world and power to distort how conditions may be conceptualised and experienced. The BMJ has just started a campaign titled Too Much Medicine, sorry it's a bit blurry, which aims to counter overdiagnosis and its associated costs. This matters, says a recent editorial, because once people are labelled with a diagnosis, a cascade of medical, social and economic consequences follows, some of which are permanent. The medical label and ensuing treatment take an emotional and financial toll on the person while also costing the health system. The explanatory model, explanatory words start to take over and become the real thing. And what patients have described that reflects the nuances and individualities of their original experience is lost, even to them, within this context. What the humanities can do, however, is take us back to the original words, peel away the coverings, find out what the technical words might have obscured, like the layers of varnish on an old painting. Now, how does this work in practice? Well, in October this year, we started work on another major Wellcome-funded project called Hearing the Voice. Hearing the voice of another person in the absence of any speaker is a pervasive feature of human experience, and one which is associated with considerable social, human and economic costs. The Hearing Voice, the Voice Project, based at Durham, is the first major interdisciplinary study of the phenomenon. It's a five-year project consisting of five interdependent programmes of research in the fields of phenomenology, cognitive neuroscience, hermeneutics, therapeutic practice and medical humanities methodology. This hearing the voice is hearing the voice in the absence of another speaker is a common experience. The prevalence is anything between but 3% and 19% in the population, most in the absence of a psychiatric diagnosis. Words are obviously of crucial importance in this project, and part of the role of the humanities scholars is to pay attention to what power the words of science have in characterising the human beings experiencing this phenomenon or implying mechanisms of action. Now, take the word signal here in this diagram. This diagram, which is describing the model for the temporal unfolding of auditory verbal hallucinations in the brain. Now, what's the force of the word signal here? We usually think of signal as something transmitted electronically, but in this case, the signal is a human voice, which may not be physically present, but misattributed as present. Mechanical signals are usually characterised as strong or weak, but voices may be loud or soft, may also be gentle or aggressive, reassuring or menacing, recognised or strange to the hearer. This kind of discussion in our research meeting, which we call Voice Club, sounds a bit groovy, have led to modifications of the research projects of the scientists. Voice hearers undergoing functional brain imaging are no longer asked just about the absence or presence of a voice, but about the timbre of the voice, the emotional response to the voice. paying attention to the meanings and nuances of the words of science is an important role for the humanities in medical research and works well, as we've seen, when humanities researchers work alongside those engaged in clinical research. So when the proponents of the fifth wave of public health talk about a need for rebalancing our models from a mechanistic understanding of ourselves as mechanics, then I think medical humanities has a role to play in indicating very specifically the potential dangers of those pervasive models and precisely how they might be reconfigured. Models of the brain may start as representative or mechanistic, but because of their visual power to explain, may become what scientists use to represent real life. Doctors in general practice may take this seriously as a model when shown at an academic presentation, but if they think about it, it in no way describes how empathic responses occur in the course of a consultation. I mean, it's laughable, really. These responses are not linear. The process is much messier, much more organic, more human. Some amazing things can happen. New metaverses and images can emerge when we start specifically to focus on experience, when we rebalance our orientation from objective to subjective. And experts by experience can be very powerful teachers. Eleanor Longdon, a voice hearer who works with us in our voice club, speaks of this orientation in this way. An important question in psychiatry shouldn't be what's wrong with you, but rather what's happened to you, she said in a recent TED talk on the internet. Over the last year, I've had the privilege of working with the writer Kathleen Jamie and the artist Bridget Collins to compile a book of words and images that illustrate the power of creativity to transform an ugly operation scar into a series of beautiful things. Kathleen, as those of you who know her work, has an uncanny ability to look and see what others cannot see and write it down. In this article, which was published in Granta last year, she talks of her recovery from mastectomy. And she writes, "One day, about 6 weeks after the operation, when the wound was healed, I was looking at my new scar in the bathroom mirror. It wraps horizontally from breastbone round to my back with a branch line into my armpit. I can only see it in the mirror, of course, with a mirror's reversals. I saw it as a sight of change, of injury, but also something in its shape made me pause. As I turned this way and that, I thought it looked like the low shores of an island seen from afar, or a river seen from above, a bird's eye view of a river, or a map. Then I fancied it looked like the stem of a rose. With that, a line of burns arrived in my head. You seize the floor, the broom is shed." Now, this creative noticing turned into a series of sittings for Bridget, from which a significant body of work began to emerge, consisting of a series of prose poems and artworks. At its heart lies a consideration of a particular way of looking. It contrasts the artist's looking with a medical gaze. In these works, which some of which I've shown you, the subject, the scar or line, Catherine writes, is not the end of the story, but instead it leads out of loss, back into the natural world and the beautiful. As I've already discussed, a key critique made by the fifth wave is that modern institutions, including those concerned with healthcare, deal entirely with the mechanistic, with what can be proven to be true via science, and ignores what is good and what is beautiful. And yet in everyday life, individuals naturally integrate all three into their decision-making and thinking. It seems to me that this very personal example illustrates clearly what can happen if the stagnant waters of a difficult medical intervention are stirred by the imagination and creativity of artists. There's no denial here that the intervention was successful and a cure was achieved. The truth of the science was clear, but the good in the sense of hope and recovery were compromised by the ugliness of what was left written on the body. Recovery and hope were set alight when the mark on the body that will forever remind the patient of their vulnerability was set free to develop into something new and beautiful with a life of its own. These images and this sense of recovery could be said to be emergent properties of the scar, combined with this complex process of noticing, sitting, conversing, drawing, painting, comparing, and letting go. So on to my final example of medical humanities work, and it takes me at last into the institutional context of public health. A couple of years ago, I established a research group on smoking with colleagues in anthropology who'd been working in this field. I got interested in it after attending a public health meeting on smoking cessation and realising how alienated I felt as a clinician turned medical humanities academic from the ways in which public health clinicians were talking about their subject. I started to ask the question, what is it about smoking that medicine and health perspective is missing? And is this missing element contributing to the fact that there's still an overall smoking prevalence of 20% in the UK, despite the ban in public places and other initiatives that have had such widespread support? And some of the research on tobacco control, it seemed to me, particularly that carried out in a clinical context, seemed, at least from the perspective of the humanities, doomed to failure because of the methods used and the framing of those methods. One study we read in our group, which explored smoking amongst disadvantaged women and was conducted in general practice, aimed to identify what role smoking had in the lives of the study group. But the methods were very unlikely to get anywhere near fulfilling that aim, as they consisted of getting women to fill in the hospital anxiety and depression scale, a knowledge of health risks measure, a measure of opinions on the effectiveness in smoking cessation practices, and then an open-ended questionnaire on smoking. It would be very, very difficult, given the steer from these methods, to find responses other than guilt about failing to give up smoking, despite some knowledge of harms to their own and health and children's health. A justification that smoking helps with coping and gets me through the day, with no mention about what it might be about smoking that's positive, dare I say, or even enjoyable. But when you turn away from the biomedical framing of public health or medicine towards the resources in view of those steeped in the humanities, a different story emerges. "I love stroking this lovely tube of delight," says Dennis Potter, the playwright of his cigarette, in his final interview before his death from pancreatic cancer. His sensuous enjoyment is echoed in the following passage from the autobiography of Spanish filmmaker Luis Buñuel. "I love to touch the pack in my pocket, open it and savour the feel of the cigarette between my fingers, the paper on my lips, the taste of tobacco on the tongue." It's as if he's talking of a lover, so intense is the quality of his physical pleasure in his cigarettes and the experience of smoking. And then finally, in the Smoking Diaries, the playwright Simon Gray describes his memories of starting smoking. "Our smoking was exhilaratively furtive, the deep, dark, swirling pleasures of the smoke being sucked into pink, fresh pink, welcoming lungs. It took me just 3 or 4 cigarettes to acquire the habit. And you know, there are still moments now when I catch more than a memory of the first suckings in, the slow leakings out, when the smoke seems to fill the nostril with far more than the experience of itself. And I regret the hundreds of thousands of cigarettes I never experienced, inhaled and exhaled without noticing." His smoking diaries describe a long, long struggle to give up, which he eventually did, but sadly he still succumbed to lung cancer. The smoker here is reveling in the feeling of smoke in the body's internal space, far more than the experience of itself. And he draws attention to the physical sensual pleasure of the act of smoking, and also the way in which smoking signifies a relationship between the bounded internal space of the body and the free, unlimited space of the external world. In the absence of engagement with the humanities, research in tobacco control has disregarded pleasure, focusing only on negative aspects of life experience, such as stress and anxiety, that, this research suggests, throw vulnerable people back on easily accessible sops. So cigarettes become drugs, with questions relating to their persistent usage directly towards that meaning and not towards lovely tubes of delight. Public health values the healthy body, but there are other ways of seeing the body through aesthetic values, such as beauty. Sensuousness and sublimity. If you look at the body in these different ways, through valuing a range of ways of being, Addiction may be true to describe relationship with cigarettes, but we have a good and beauty, the sensuous and sublime, to contend with as well. We might develop a more nuanced interpretation of the role smoking has as a coping mechanism for particularly women in low-income contexts. A lot of tobacco control research, coping has become a kind of shorthand for the complex interdependence between human beings and cigarettes, where in many ethnographic studies, smokers talk of their cigarettes as friends or companions or partners. If we take a phenomenological approach and frame the experience of smoking more widely within an embodied existence that recognises the boundary between our bodies and the external world, we might come to a deeper understanding of the idea of smoking as coping. The lungs represent a space within the body that is bounded, but nevertheless connected to the outside world by the spontaneous activity of breathing. Drawing in smoke and then exhaling it makes that connection between inside and outside visible. For those for whom the world is a difficult place, smoking could convey some symbolic control over that connection between the body and the world. Smoking can contain and stifle that connection, allowing the person struggling with external pressures to attain at least vicarious protection from the hostile space of the world. Now, this kind of analysis is not amenable to scientific explanation. It's quite mysterious. Matthew Radcliffe, a philosopher of phenomenology who's working with us in Durham on the Hearing the Voice project, maintains that, I quote, "doctrines like scientific naturalism, that is the biomedical worldview, which assume their own ability to encompass absolutely everything, are guilty of hubris. And if these doctrines were actually lived, they would be existentially unbearable. Very difficult to live with the idea that that's the way your body is." And he quotes another philosopher, David Cooper, who suggests that as an alternative to the approach of this worldview, that is the biomedical, we attune ourselves to mystery. Cooper says, "There's a way the world independently is, and this way is not discursible." So if we apply this to a particularly pressing problem in UK tobacco control, it seems clear from a recent review of qualitative research examining smoking and pregnancy that many women suffer from a sense of emotional disruption at this time in their lives. Hilary Graham's team at York carried out a review of qualitative research on smoking and pregnancy, and their findings present a group of women dealing with a major change in their sense of being, that is pregnancy, and also having to cope with guilt, confusion, stress, because of pressures on them to quit smoking. Many pregnant women report coercion from partners who do not feel the need to quit themselves, or struggle with a sense that it's their only pleasure during this difficult time. Others are caught in a constant stressful carousel of being a smoker, attempting to become a non-smoker, then relapsing back to smoking. And I think the result of this must be a kind of ontological strife, a confusion and disruption of being, such as that that is described by the existential philosopher Jean-Paul Sartre in Being and Nothingness. And he says when he attempted to quit, he says, "It seemed to me that in giving up smoking, I was going to strip the film of its interest, the evening meal of its savour, the morning work of its fresh animation. Whatever unexpected happening was going to meet my eye, it seemed to me that it was fundamentally impoverished from the moment I could not welcome it by smoking. To be capable of being met by me smoking, such was the concrete quality which had been spread over everything. It seemed to me that I was going to snatch it away from everything, and that in the midst of this universal impoverishment, life was not so worth living." He actually did achieve it, but only by recognising the sense of the way in which his sense of self was bound up with being a smoker. So I think this sense of being in the world is mysterious, but the only way we as human beings understand it is in relation to others and to the material things of the world. It's not discursible, but it's certainly sensible and it's experienceable. A recent study that aimed to investigate why midwives had difficulties in delivering smoking cessation advice to women in the northeast of England, where the prevalence of smoking in pregnancy is over 22%, as opposed to 14% in the rest of the UK, found that the midwives did not lack the knowledge or resources to deliver this advice, but found it difficult to do, faced with women whom they were there to support and in whom they sensed, I think, this confusion of feelings. Their behaviour, that of the midwives, was analysed like this, broken down atomistically. But what the study authors did not take into account is that midwives' experience like this, with their own influences, the presence of the woman and her background, and most importantly, whatever mysterious essence inhabits the interpersonal space between and around. And I'm calling this a kind of affective atmosphere. There's a lot more to say about that. It's certainly scientifically true that smoking is implicated in perinatal death, miscarriage and preterm delivery. But I'd be quite interested to ask the provocative question, what is the relationship between these outcomes and repeated failed quit attempts and the resultant distress to the mother? Here we mustn't ignore the good, which is that what may feel good for the midwife in a relationship with her patient is that maybe the best thing for the mother is to reduce to just those cigarettes she feels able to keep her on an even keel rather than giving up altogether. That's very scary to say in a public health context, but anyway, provocative. Okay, I'm going to draw some of these tracks together. So returning to the emergent qualities of the fifth wave, the public health community is dealing not with simple systems that can be predicted and controlled, but with complex adaptive systems. And with multiple points of equilibrium that are sensitive to small changes in the system. So I've talked about people in communities are organic, adaptive, creative, can come up with their own ways of transforming illnesses and moving on. And the Fisher example, Kathleen's work, shows that. From difficult situations, extraordinary creative responses can emerge. There's a need to rebalance the mindset from anti to pro, in dominion and independence to interdependence and cooperation. In our voice club for the Hearing the Voice project, we're working with and learning from voice hearers who may or may not have a psychiatric diagnosis. We've also much to learn from other disciplinary perspectives, which may enable those of us whose perspectives have been dominated by biomedicine to see this work differently and frame questions about it in new ways. Such refreshing perspectives will be better able us to undertake the necessary rebalancing of our models from mechanistic to organic. And it's clear, I hope, from my example, that in medical humanities we're working to influence mechanistic models that have come to stand for reality in biomedical science, not dismissing them, but building in perspectives that will enable these models to be more effective. Medical humanities has as its central aim to rebalance our orientation from objective to subjective, to lived experience and inner transformation. As our voice hearer Eleanor Longdon says, don't ask what's the matter, ask what's happened. I've said less about the fifth point, that in order to develop a future consciousness to inform the present, we need to do that in order to enable us to develop innovation to feed the future. But it seems to me it's what's important for this to happen is we recognise the inevitability of change, development, and adaptation to new circumstances. This is implicit in this sort of philosophical and anthropological idea of becoming. It's a purchase in anthropological circles to conceptualise the development of cultural groups over time. That's something I could say a bit more about. And the final emergent quality, we need to iterate and scale up through learning. And I hope that everything I've said has illustrated this process of learning is absolutely integral to the way in which medical humanities goes about its business. Our approach is by definition interdisciplinary. Our work in Hearing the Voice involves a constant process of learning from other scholars and from our voice hearing partners. But there is a real challenge, I think, from the work that we're doing in our field, which is about the interpersonal and those kinds of interactions to population level collective thinking. But at the heart of this, I think, is what I attempted to articulate in the smoking example, that human beings function best and learn best in the interpersonal or intersubjective space, where all our cognitive understanding, skills, physical instincts, emotions, insights, as well as our more mysterious existential feelings are primed, are in use. This openness makes us vulnerable to sink under the pressures of large bureaucracies, where atmospheres may be imbued with fear, suspicion and failure, such as happened in North Staffordshire Hospital. We have the power to affect interpersonal and institutional atmospheres with new cultures. And this mysterious quality of people individually and collectively can be a potential powerful agent of change within a cultural community open to learning and aware of its potential to develop for the better. There's so much more to discuss and develop here. I feel as if this is really the beginning of a conversation. But if I remember back to that meeting with Phil and Andrew late last year, one simple but important insight stayed with me and resonated with a quotation from the anthropologist Margaret Mead. We may not be able to change things overnight, but never doubt that a small group of thoughtful, committed citizens can change the world. Indeed, it's the only thing that ever has. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.